From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Maddie's Place, Spokane's neonatal nursery for drug-addicted infants and their parents, is in an interesting place. It has operated for more than 3 years with a patchwork of funding. We'll talk with Chief Executive Sean Cross about working with the legislature this session to find permanent funding sources. And we'll talk about how the nursery is exporting its care model to cities all over the country. We'll hear from Spokane medical resident Logan Patterson, who believes medical students need more instruction to help patients at the ends of their lives. And Eliza Billingham takes us to Spokane's West Central Abbey, which will receive an infusion of cash to make some improvements if it can raise some money from the community. A trio of artists are stepping in to help. That's this week's Inland Journal. Stay with us. For more than 3 years, Maddie's Place has cared for babies who were born to mothers with drug addictions. Many of those children inherit the addictions. They show physical symptoms, including fussiness or irritability. Parts of their bodies may not be fully formed. They may have intellectual disabilities. Maddie's Place cares not only for the babies as they go through detox, but also for the parents who work to overcome their addictions. The nursery has survived on grants from Washington State, Spokane City and County, and private donations. Its chief executive, Sean Cross, says while he's grateful for the support, it's not a sustainable funding model. He's asking the legislature to change the law to allow the state to pay for the nursery services using funding from its Medicaid program. Cross recently made his case to a Washington State Senate committee.
We provided free medical services to 171 infants suffering from neonatal abstinence syndrome. We've also provided free treatment and wraparound services to 170 of their parents, including free room and board to 95 of those parents. The stat that is catching the attention of people in Olympia and D.C. is this. Of the parents who have stayed at Maddie's Place full-time with their infants, a remarkable 88% are in recovery today, in custody of that infant, and housed. Washington's neonatal abstinence syndrome rates were almost twice the national average in 2022. In my hometown of Spokane, the NAS rate is 340% the national rate in 2022, and I can tell you it's gotten a lot worse in the last 3 years. The bottom line is this, the evidence and data that we've gathered over 40 months of operations and through a one-year study and a three-year pilot project points to a new, more effective model of care for infants and parents going through withdrawal after birth. Maddie's model is more effective than our current hospital-based model because the model of care impacts not only the infant, but also the parents, the dyad. Instead of giving morphine to an infant in an isolette for 30 days at $2,500 a day, we can do it for about a third and take care of the mom also and her recovery and not have the infant go into the foster care system.
The bill to benefit Maddie's Place is sponsored by Spokane State Senators at opposite ends of the ideological spectrum, Democrat Marcus Riccielli and Republican Leonard Christian. Both say they were convinced to sign on after visiting the nursery. But the most powerful testimonials at the committee hearing came from parents, Maddie's Place alumni. Here are two of them.
I'm David Aga. I'm here today testifying in support of this bill because I have my own story to tell about my experience with the only clinic in Washington State, Maddie's Place. I met my fiance Kayla, and we ended up getting pregnant with our daughter, Deborah. Even then, we were still struggling badly with addiction throughout the pregnancy. When Deborah was born, we were introduced to a place called Maddie's Place, a place where we could still see our daughter while trying to get clean. At first, I was skeptical. I thought it would be like every other place, judgmental, cold, and making me feel like a monster. But I couldn't have been more wrong. From the first day we walked in, Maddie's Place treated us like family. Today, we are almost 3 years clean, housed, have full custody of my older boys, and are truly living our best life. I've never felt this happy, and I owe so much of that to God and to Maddie's Place.
Hi, my name is Samantha, and in August 2004, me and my daughter Charlotte spent about six weeks at Maddie's Place. Maddie's Place wasn't just a roof over our heads, it was safety. It was the first place where I was allowed to recover and to be a mother at the same time while my baby got the extra support she needed. It gave me a safe place to stay sober, to heal emotionally, and to start putting our lives together. The support I received there changed everything. Because of Maddie's Place, my daughter got something I never thought I could give her, stability. She got safety. She got a chance to heal alongside of me, to bond with me, and to grow up knowing that her mom is present. Today, I'm still standing, I'm still sober, and I get to be her mom. Maddie's Place didn't just save my life, they kept my family together, and for that, I will always be grateful.
It's not clear yet whether that bill will become law, but Sean Cross says one thing that is not in doubt is the influence that Maddie's Place is having in other communities. He told us this week that the nursery has done a great job sharing its story via social media.
We're now up to 400,000 followers. We have about 240,000 on Facebook and about 80,000 each on Instagram and TikTok. And I've got some young women that are really good at this and are putting up a ton of content on those three platforms. And we didn't know if we were going to get any funding from the legislature last year, and we were going to have to close down. So we kind of started to ring the bell last April, just during the last 2 weeks of the session or 10 days of the session. And we just started getting money from all over Helongon. It was the damnedest thing I've ever seen. I mean, all 50 states, 17 countries, 5 military bases, a couple hundred thousand. And the thing that was really intriguing to me is that we were getting these comments from all around the world and all around the country, but the main theme was we have to have one of these clinics in our community.
So last fall, Cross and Maddie's Place sponsored a series of seminars for organizations interested in developing similar programs in their communities.
And the idea was basically to give people the tools, the templates. You want articles, bylaws, you want policies and procedures, you want staffing ratios, you want details on our model, you want to have, you know, research that we've looked at and from Johns Hopkins on that, and we'll provide all of that, no charge, no nothing. So we found out that there were about 300 that ran the course and very, very talented people around the country with we found 41 clusters in 35 states. And so we sort of ranked them by, okay, there's this many in this state, this many in this state. There's this many in Dallas. There's this many in, you know, Melbourne, Florida, whatever. And then we started to talk to them. And then we said, okay, there's a fork in the road. You can either be kind of faith-based with your 501c3 or you can be secular. I decided to go, I'm a strong Christian, but I decided to go secular for lots of different reasons. Do you want to just do this on your own independently, or would you like to be affiliated with Maddie's Place? Well, a great number, I think, are fine being secular and want to be associated with Maddie's Place. So I've started to form all these single member LLCs under subsidiaries. So we have a Maddie's Place Florida LLC. We have a Maddie's Place Vancouver with a large group in Portland LLC. We have a Maddie's Place Housing, and we're looking at forming Maddie's Places in Texas and in Oklahoma.
What's the benefit to all these organizations to be affiliated with Maddie's Place?
Well, the benefit for them is that, you know, it's taken, I've been working on this for 9 years. It'll probably, you know, we've got the playbook now, so it'll probably save them 5 or 6 years of how to go about this and the difficulties that are there. And then they'll have our model of care, our staffing ratios, our policies and procedures, our brand, and we can oversee these from Spokane. Our senior leadership can oversee this, so you're spreading our overhead. And in return for that, we've prepared intercompany agreements between Maddie's Place and the LLCs with the Oregon group. So we have the template. So they pay us 8% of everything that they raise in Portland, or 8% of everything they raise in Florida or Texas. And so I'm going to be, you know, going around a lot raising money in these different places. But then that'll be another funding source for Maddie's Place for the parent. So I'm trying to diversify the revenue, get as many payment streams as we can while I'm a young man, and get as many of these going as I can.
So let's finish with this. I think you've become more comfortable with the fact that your future is a little more solid, stable than it used to be.
Right.
As you look 5 years down the road, is this going to be the best practices for taking care of children and families like this?
I think there's a real opportunity for that. We have a bill that is working its way through Congress right now called the Miracle Act that I've been involved with for the last several years. And it basically would direct Health and Human Services to do a 3-year comprehensive study of the prevalence of what's called neonatal abstinence syndrome, the substance exposure and the effect on infants, and then also the outcomes at the 5 clinics that we're aware of in the United States. It's already been introduced in the House with 3 bipartisan co-sponsors. But the idea there is that once the states get the data on how bad this is, because we're kind of operating in flying the plane blindly right now, the idea is once they see what a third of all live births are substance exposed, we've got that's happening in our hospitals. And once they see this model and become aware of it and what's happening at these clinics, I think that there's a good chance that a lot of the states will amend their state Medicaid plan and also deal with their own version of DCYF to have funding models for this. And so the bills that have been introduced in Washington State, I think, could provide a template for other states.
Sean Cross is the chief executive for the Maddie's Place Neonatal Nursery in Spokane. We go from a story about treating people at the beginning of life to one about treating people at the end of life. Spokane medical resident Logan Patterson, a recent WSU College of Medicine graduate, wishes he had been taught more about how to relate to and care for patients who are preparing to die. He and others from WSU wrote a paper about the subject for the journal Academic Medicine.
I think part of it is experience-based. I think most medical students have some sort of exposure to death within their family. For me, it was my grandmother and her decline with Alzheimer's disease and then subsequent passing. That was a big motivating factor for me deciding to apply to medical school in the first place and become a doctor, which was a big change for me because I was a tech consultant briefly between undergrad and medical school. But more foundationally, it's both an area of interest of mine because of it being such a neglected topic within medicine in general. I think part of it's temperamental. Being around death is even for people that are trained and as part of their job, physicians and doctors, it still can affect people very heavily. And so you'll get like really wide variations in personality type and how much it affects them. I seem to be someone who's able to discuss really heavy topics with patients and not take it home with me as much. And so part of it, I think, is just I view it as a skill that I have and that I should make use of.
So when you went through medical school, what was kind of the extent of your training when it came to end-of-life issues?
Medical school, of course, varies quite a lot institution to institution. But for me, it was really theoretical discussions in small groups. I remember one simulated encounter, which was basically delivering bad news. It wasn't specifically discussing advanced life or advanced care planning or goals of care, things like that. It was more just delivering a diagnosis that could be terminal. It wasn't that wasn't necessarily part of the scenario. So very limited, I would say, and mostly couched in sort of like theoretical discussions, not really anything practice-based.
What would you like to see happen in terms of a med school curriculum when it comes to end-of-life issues?
I think that the ideal situation, you would see it basically threaded throughout all 4 years of medical education. The first 2 years of medical education are basically classroom learning. And so I think in those early years, it should really be a combination of learning about different aspects of end of life, like advanced care planning, goals of care, that type of thing. Maybe seeing or having a couple simulated encounters with sort of actors that are pretending to be patients. Maybe having family or patients with terminal diagnosis, family of patients with terminal diagnosis after they've passed, talk about their own experiences. Because a lot of what we do is basically helping to relieve the stress that is put on families having to make these decisions that they don't know the answers to because they never had the discussion. And then I think in the later years, I would ideally like to see, this is a very pie in the sky hope, but I think it would be great for basically every medical student to be part of, to even do a brief rotation with palliative care, because that's basically, I think, the only way you're going to guarantee that a medical student will see these types of discussions in depth with enough frequency to become ideally more competent at them.
So you sort of alluded to this, your experience with your grandmother. What did you learn through going through her process of dying and that? What did you learn?
I think probably my biggest takeaway, because I was involved a bit more directly in her care while I was in high school, but more distantly while I was in undergrad, because I wasn't in the same geographic area. But I definitely remember pretty well how much it affected my dad, who was his mother. It was his mother. And just really like the stress that these types of slow declines can have on the family. Some of that is just inevitable, and it's just part of life that the end chapters can be difficult for people to navigate. But there's so many other things that, like logistical things, goals of care, knowing what someone wants, sort of helping put or giving over, power of attorney for healthcare decision making, designating someone to help make financial decisions for you, things like that, that could really have made the journey a lot easier, because she encountered so many issues towards the end of her life that maybe some of them could have been avoided or made easier on her as the patient, and also on my dad and my family at large, if this sort of like planning and discussions had happened earlier while she was still more lucid.
So now you're going to be a cancer doctor yourself. And how is Yes. your experience, and then maybe what you learned at WSU, how does that help you become a better cancer doctor?
So cancer, of course, as everyone knows, is a disease that is often terminal. Within radiation specifically, you'll hear different numbers from different radiation oncologists, but generally it's something like 25 to 50% of what we do is palliative radiation, which means we're not doing it with the goal of curing the disease. We're doing it with the goal of prolonging someone's life or making their symptoms better. And so being able to have these sorts of like discussions with patients about what you can potentially help them with, and then basically being able to convey that this is not curative treatment, that what we're doing here is really trying to help you live the best life as long as possible while you're still here. And so these types of discussions ideally should be had regularly with oncologists whenever you meet a patient for the first time. It's not always the case, but I think the skills are very transferable.
So you've written about this in a paper. I assume this was for medical school as part of your process through medical school. What do you hope people get out of that paper?
I think my biggest hope is really that it starts to like lay a better foundational understanding about what types of teaching methods are used for this subject in medical school. Because one of the big takeaways for us was really that there is a huge variation in how different institutions try to approach it. We saw some programs doing what I described earlier and having a fully integrated curriculum throughout all 4 years of medical school, but mostly it was one-off interventions, the occasional simulated patient encounter, the occasional workshop, is very scattered, not a lot of similarities in how the effectiveness of these interventions were assessed. And so it basically creates a situation where it's hard to know what the best way to teach it is, because we haven't really been doing much research on it. So I would hope that this would at least help establish a bit of a foundational understanding about what type of research and what type of interventions are happening.
Logan Patterson is a recent WSU Medical School graduate, now in his first year of medical residency. Beginning this summer, he'll start a 4-year radiation oncology residency in San Francisco. Spokane's West Central Abbey has been a central fixture in its neighborhood for more than a century. It's gone through phases of use, neglect, and revitalization. The Abbey serves its neighborhood well, but for one basic function, and that is on its way to being addressed thanks to a grant from the National Fund for Sacred Places. But first, the Abbey has to raise its own funds to match that grant. So it's asking the help of local artists, either secular or sacred, who have drawn upon the church for their own work. SBR's Eliza Bellingham reports.
Jess Walter's latest novel, So Far Gone, is about estranged grandfather Reese Kinnick reuniting with his grandchildren. In this scene that Walter reads, Reese takes his grandson Asher to a chess tournament.
The chess tournament, according to Mrs. Gaines, was being held at an old abbey in West Central Spokane, the city's oldest working-class neighborhood. The Spokane Chess Club met in this 19th-century Episcopal church, a barn-red steepled church building with an abbot's house attached. A sign out front read, "We cultivate justice, joy, compassion, and peace." There were only four cars in the gravel parking lot, a few more on the street. Reese parked and turned back to consider his grandson. "You ready to go get him, Kasparov?" Asher looked up from his paper and notebook, suddenly seeming panicked. "I have to pee." "I'm sure there's a bathroom in there." "I hope so."
How did you find out that the Abbey doesn't actually have a bathroom inside?
Well, Katie Shedlock reached out to me and asked if I would help in this fundraising effort to try to put a bathroom in the Abbey. So until that point, I just sort of assumed there was one. I've lived in West Central for 22 years and walked by that beautiful building on my way to second breakfast most days. And so I suppose I should have done a little more research, but I think it speaks to my abilities as an author that I think it would be easier to raise money to put a bathroom in the Abbey than to go change a sentence in my book.
To be fair to Walter, the Abbey technically does have a bathroom, but it's not inside the Abbey. It's in the parish hall next door and requires a walk outside to get to it. The caretakers of the Abbey hope that's about to change. West Central Abbey was the second church in Washington to receive a grant from the National Trust of Sacred Places. That's $50,000 to keep the building usable. To Reverend Katie Shedlock, that means a bathroom in the same building as the sanctuary. And there should be enough money to replace the cedar shingles that are falling off the roof, too. The grant is a matching grant. The Abbey got news of the award in 2024, but it needs to raise its own $50,000 first. So Shedlock asked three West Central writers who have been inspired in some way by the old church to host a reading. They'll hold that reading next week, and all proceeds from that will go towards matching the grant. But what is it about the Abbey that has captured both local and national attention?
The National Fund for Sacred Places, they really look for what I think can be kind of a unique blend of they want really cool historic buildings and they want churches that are really committed to serving their communities.
Shedlock says the Abbey is actually a Gothic chapel with some original stained glass windows and others that were painted in the 1970s.
The colors are really vivid and vibrant, and the lighting in the space is pretty low, and especially as you're coming in from outside, you know, you kind of adjust to the light.
As your eyes adjust, you can see huge wood beams curve up to a vaulted ceiling.
People almost always look up when they come in the door. People almost always, their shoulders kind of drop, which I think is about putting down whatever burdens that we have.
Though the space has an ancient feel, the church's mission is progressive. Parishioners give out Narcan at free Wednesday night meals. The sanctuary pews circle around a wobbly communion table instead of facing the high altar. And its hymnal includes Be Thou My Vision and Brandy Carlile.
We've done free funerals for people from our dinner table community who wouldn't have otherwise had a beautiful space in which to say goodbye.
Even though West Central is built on a grid, Dean Avenue takes an unexpected curve around the Abbey. The red building kind of juts out into the pavement. Shedlock says that's what first earned the Abbey its nickname, Church in the Streets.
I love that image of the church in the streets. I think a way that connects to our congregation now is we have a lot of people who are deeply passionate about social justice, people who are willing to go protest for things that they believe in.
And for our detail-oriented listeners, no, this isn't actually an abbey.
So an abbey, historically speaking, is a place where people who have taken vows of living together in religious community would live and work. We are not an abbey in that traditional sense, but we have some things that we do hold in common with abbeys of the past. One is that we have this big giant garden, and agricultural life was often a part of monastic work and life together. We have lots of really creative folks who are people who practice the arts in lots of different ways.
There's even a banner above the doorway that encourages whoever is leaving the sanctuary to go live creatively.
English novelist David Jones describes creativity, basically art making, as the surest sign of our own createdness.
Tom Caraway is a Whitworth professor, a book printer, an author, and a poet. He's one of the writers who will read at the fundraising event, and he gives entire lectures on the overlap of sacredness and creativity.
You don't need to make art. We must make art, right? Our souls demand it. And so why is that? And I think it's because, like, that is that creativity is the expression, the outer expression of our own inner sacredness. And you can call it whatever you want in different people from different spiritual backgrounds or different belief systems or without belief systems at all.
But what makes a place sacred?
I probably have a much more working class idea of sacred spaces.
That's Jess Walter again.
I grew up next to a drive-in movie theater, which was a little bit sacred to me. Anytime I go by a basketball court in the middle of a city, that's kind of a sacred place for me. Every library branch to me speaks of the sacred. And so, you know, I think there are a lot of different places where we transcend the everyday and the regular.
He says church services never really did that for him. Same goes for Lena Crowe, an author, creative writing prof, and West Central resident who will also read at the fundraiser.
I don't think about sacredness, but I like the notion of it. And I would say, you know, as a person who's more connected to the arts than I am to, I think, conventional notions of religion, that art does feel sacred. You know, I guess I would think of sacredness as something that's essential in a very core way, either on an individual level or a community level.
And do you think the neighborhood would lose anything if the Abbey kind of fell into disrepair?
Oh, definitely. The Abbey is, in a really practical sense, it's a place that's providing social services in West Central in a really, like, welcoming and low barrier way. It's also a historical building that's really beautiful and interesting and kind of anchors the neighborhood that it's in a way. Like, it is, it's a landmark. So I think that that would be a tremendous loss if anything ever happened to the Abbey. It's also connected to a lot of the other organizations that are in West Central. So yeah, it's definitely a neighborhood hub.
I mean, there are places in West Central that are important, useful, and meaningful. The Abbey is one of the only ones that is all three. It's a working symbol, right? Like, they're doing good work there. They're doing good work for the soul. They're doing good work for the bodies of the neighborhood and the population that they serve. Like, the spirit that flows out of it comes back to it.
You know, it's fallen into disrepair before. And so I like to think human nature and the desire for connection would mean that it would come back in some other way. But it's got such good caretakers right now, and they care not just about their own particular faith and the space, but they also care about the neighborhood and the people around it.
I think on the one hand, a sacred place can be any place, right? Because God is everywhere. I think if I were to give someone a list of, like, here are Katie Shedlock's top five sacred places, they're all places where something meaningful really happened that helped me understand myself and the world in a different way. And I certainly hope that that's what happens here.
The reading will take place on Friday, February 6th at the Abbey. If you attend, just make sure to ask someone where the bathroom is.
That's SBR's Eliza Billingham. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SBR News. It's on the radio every Thursday at 12:30, every Saturday at 2:30, and online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. You can also find there our daily podcast, which is uploaded each weekday morning at 7:30. Thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.